Hey, it's Carl Brizzi with another episode of Carl Brizzi Live. Thanks for tuning in. Here with Rob Kendall, my producer. Rob, thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure, Carl.
So I don't know about you, brother, but I'm concerned as a former prosecutor, as a criminal defense attorney, and I'm working hard not to reach conclusions regarding the motivations behind the FBI raid. And now with this this stuff now coming out about Hannity's, whether it's an attorney-client relationship or whatever kind of relationship he has with the president's longtime lawyer, Michael Cohen. So I guess it was, what, last week that the raid happened on Cohen's office?
Right.
So, yeah, last week. Now, here's what I think everyone who's listening, it's important to understand, and you may already know this, but I've looked at the U.S. Attorney's manual, and in the manual, it explicitly warns investigators, and by investigators, I mean the FBI, those are typically Justice Department investigators, to exhaust all other ways of obtaining evidence first, and this is a quote, to avoid impinging on valid attorney-client relationships, end quote. It encourages, Rob, using subpoenas if possible, resorting to a search warrant only if unusual factors are present, such as reason to believe that the person who has the records is going to destroy them.
Help me understand what attorney-client privilege actually is and what you can give to an attorney that the government can't take from you. Because right now it seems like they could get anything. And it seems like this judge was like, oh, we trust the government. They wouldn't do anything wrong.
Well, right. And don't let me not get into that here before we end this. But so attorney-client privilege obviously is when you have when you are in a relationship, when you even if, right, you don't even necessarily, we don't even necessarily have to have an agreement. It's not necessarily essential for money to have been exchanged for us to have an attorney-client relationship. Some of it depends on what you subjectively believe in terms of the advice that I'm giving you. So when we talk about like Sean Hannity, for instance, and Sean Hannity's come out and said, hey, look, he's not my lawyer. There's no documentation. There was no retention. I didn't pay him, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't mean necessarily that there isn't an attorney-client relationship. I know that Hannity wants to kind of avoid the appearance that Cohen may have been his lawyer. But just because those things that I just stated didn't happen doesn't mean that he's not the lawyer. And the kind of things, Rob, that you can tell your attorney is basically anything.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, like, okay, I know you're not in the business of working for free, but there's times where I'll look at you and be like, hey, Carl, what do you think about this? Mm-hmm. Like, you're a man of the law. I am not. What do you think? You're not my attorney, though.
Well, right. I mean, this would be a show, right? So we're talking about on the show. So that, I don't think there would be an expectation of attorney-client privilege.
But I mean, even off the air, like you and I are shooting the bull, I'll ask mm-hmm. you, hey, what's your legal opinion on this? You know, or Abdul, you know, that doesn't make you guys my attorney.
Well,
at what
right.
point do you become the attorney?
You know, if there's a reasonable expectation that you are relying upon that advice, I mean, if you were to ask me a serious question in a cocktail party, I mean, the argument could be made, you know, if you relied on the advice that I gave you, and if I made, you know, if I didn't preface it by saying, hey, look, I don't know, you need to go talk to someone else, you know, I'm not saying you would win on this if things hit the fan, but you might have a case to
That's
argue.
Really interesting. Is that why on these legal shows all the time they're running that thing on a loop? This is not legal advice.
That's
Please
right.
consult your legal professional.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, because lawyers have to protect themselves because they could say something, you know, informally. Somebody could rely on that and then bad things could happen.
Right.
And then they, you know, the next thing you know, they're contacting their malpractice carrier. But with this raid on Cohen's office, like unless, you know, the FBI, and of course, we still don't know what the FBI was relying on for this,
right.
for this probable cause. You know, we're standing there getting ready to torch some documents. You know, it's not like he was a drug dealer who could flush the evidence down the toilet. I mean, that's exigent circumstances for sure. Or, you know, an armed felon who posed a threat to law enforcement. I mean, that's certainly a situation where you need to do sort of a pre-dawn raid kind of thing, which is what they did in this case. So, look, these kind of heavy-handed tactics are not unusual with the federal government. I mean, they use these kind of tactics to, you know, not only on suspects, but on witnesses to intimidate and harass and to make sure they get leverage on them. Basically, they're trying to scare them.
Right. And my question is, from a layperson perspective, Where is the line? Because an attorney-client privilege is very sacred, but I can't also use you to help me cover up a crime and go, oh, attorney-client privilege.
Correct, right. And so that presumably is what the Justice Department has spelled out in the probable cause affidavit for this kind of, you know, for this kind of raid. Now, yesterday, I think, or was it today, that the court ruled that...
Yesterday,
that they were not going to be able to prevent DOJ from looking at these documents. And here's the other thing, and Alan Dershowitz actually wrote a column about this, which is interesting because, you know, here he is, the left wing, you know, one of the greatest lawyers in the world.
OJ guy.
Yeah. I mean, here he is sort of on the right side of the issue, but his point is, look, this whole idea of a taint team is ridiculous and is unconstitutional. And for those of you who may not know what a taint team is when you have a situation like this and they create this construct, it's a fictional construct in my mind, where they have different lawyers other than the lawyers who are investigating the case look through the seized documents to determine whether or not privilege applies. Now, I find this bizarre because the lawyers are all from the U.S. Attorney's Office or from the Department of Justice, but we're creating this sort of, you know, bright line in the sand that the documents that have been seen can all of a sudden become unseen.
So who would be a good, for lack of a better term, moral arbiter of what's attorney-client privilege and what's not?
Well, if you're going to allow these kinds of seizures, which I think kind of per se violate the attorney-client privilege, unless, of course, there's a demonstrative showing that there was collusion with a crime between the lawyer and the client, then it has to default to the judge, I would think, rather than having DOJ review everything.
Because a lot of the things they could see, even if they're not a part of a crime, they could be personal things that Trump doesn't want seen. And once these people have seen it, we all know how the leaks work, then all the stuff about Trump's personal life starts getting out.
Well, not only that, but look at what just occurred with Hannity, with Sean Hannity, because Cohen, in this case, apparently only had three clients, and Sean Hannity was maybe one of the three clients. I mean, that's a great practice right there.
Let me ask you that. Is that normal?
Well, you know, who was it? Not Sonny, but who was Michael Corleone's... What was his name in The Godfather?
Yeah, the very famous, went on to become a very famous actor.
Yeah, you remember when he went to go see the Hollywood producer and he goes, I've heard of every big shot lawyer in this town. Who do you represent? And he goes, sir, I have one client. You know, unless you're him. Oh,
Robert Duvall.
Robert Duvall played, it's going to kill me. Okay, I'll think about it.
So if you're...
Yes, that's unusual.
Yeah, but if it's Trump, right?
Well, right, that's your guy. And Trump is obviously keeping his lawyers very busy. So, but look what just happened to Hannity. Hannity has an expectation of privacy with his lawyer. I mean, yeah, he's a big mouth, he's a blowhard, he's all these things, fine. But he has an expectation of privacy. That said, I'm going to footnote this. I think it was completely unethical for him to go on the air and bash the raid like he did, given that he has a very vested interest in keeping that relationship secret. I don't blame him for keeping that relationship secret. I'm just saying that seems to me a bit disingenuous on his part because that's an obvious conflict of interest. When we come back, we're going to talk about the raid and what it represents in terms of, I think it's punitive, and also Facebook and what this nonsense about algorithms is and how they're censoring speech. When we come back, Carl Brizzi Live. Hey, it's Carl Brizzi. Thanks for listening to the podcast. When I was prosecutor, I worked for victims. I worked for holding wrongdoers accountable for their actions. I've now returned to private practice, but I continue to fight for injured victims, and I've collected millions for my clients. I'm Lewis and Wilkins, and I'm easy to find on your smartphone. You type in Carl Brizzi Live or on Facebook, carlbrizzilive.com. All right, it's Carl Brizzi with Carl Brizzi Live. We're talking about the raid on attorney Mike Cohen's office, and what, here's why this is so important, right? Regardless of your politics, because I know that some people on the left are like jumping up and down in glee at this because they you know, hate Trump so much. That's fine. I really don't. That part of this political game, I really don't care that much about. But what I do care about is what I see as erosion of protected principles, right? Whether it's the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, Fourth. I mean, just go down the line. And what I think we are seeing in modern day society, and I think this phenomenon, if that's what you want to call it, so I'm calling it, is rapidly increasing. And I see an erosion of these basic rights principles that we have sort of embedded in our culture. And what this raid is helping to do is undermine the protections that surround fundamental relationships. And what do I mean by fundamental relationships? Well, the law, you know, just like the jurisprudence of the American legal system respects the divine worth of every human being, right? There are other relationships that are constructs of the law that have been around forever, right? Like the priest and the parishioner, right? Privilege, doctor-patient, husband-wife, those sorts of things. Attorney-client was, hopefully still is in some respects, you know, one of those respected privileges that, but for very special circumstances, ought not be infringed upon. And what I think people are, you know, what a consequence of this might be, and this is why we ought not be jumping up and down and cheer for it, regardless of your political affiliation, is that if ordinary citizens, if they see that even the president of the United States, even if his confidential communications with his lawyer, if those can be seized and perused under the pretense of a taint team, I think that those people in circumstances where they need to consult a lawyer will somehow be less willing or more apprehensive to share information with their lawyers.
Hey, Carl, let me ask you this real quick. They haven't said what they're going after, right? I mean, it's
correct.
They've made the statement like some like his business dealings.
Well, and there was some allusion to Stormy Trump and the payment, and then there was another reference to something else that was unrelated to that.
If you're going to go into an attorney's office and search his premises with all sorts of conceivably personal, private information, shouldn't you be obligated to be like, here's why we went?
Yes.
Here's what we're looking for.
Well, that's what I think, right? And so, and what is it? Okay, clearly whatever they articulated, they've already articulated is for the judge to sign off on it. And now what I don't understand is, why isn't this information being released in terms of the justification? Because they already have the records. So what now? What harm are they fearing by not releasing the probable cause that justified the seizure in the first place? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. So to take, and I know you weren't a federal prosecutor; you were a county prosecutor.
I was a real prosecutor. I think that's what you mean.
You guys don't like the feds? Is that
just
the deal?
Saying that we don't necessarily play well?
Oh, so you guys didn't like? You guys didn't get along, or
no? Because you know the thing was, and you can ask any local prosecutor this: is that the feds like to cherry pick?
Yeah.
And they only take the best cases.
You're right.
And they never lose because they take the best cases.
So it's not that they're good.
Well, you know, when you have the unlimited resources of the federal government.
Right.
And you only take the best cases. Yeah, you have a 95% conviction record.
Yeah. So it doesn't make you good. It just means it'd be like picking the best players on a sports team.
Well, of course. Yeah.
Right. So when you would go for a search warrant, like did you ever search an attorney's office or whatever?
No.
I mean, that seems like, I don't know. I mean,
I had to think.
Well,
no.
I mean, it seems like there's sort of like, what do they call that? Professional courtesy or whatever?
Well, you know, there's no professional courtesy when it comes to the federal government. And they're going to do what they have to do. Let's just give them the benefit of the doubt. But this information needs to be released. And the government will eventually have to justify this raid. And in my humble opinion, anything short of Mr. Cohen, you know, stoking a raging fire with the incriminating papers in hand is gonna fall short to me, because what it rests on is this idea of this taint team. And this, it all goes back to the taint team, is that the judge is gonna let the federal prosecutors, the separate team of federal prosecutors, vet the materials first. And here's the problem I have with that. Look, if this was 2 years ago, you know, maybe I wouldn't be as strident about it. But now, but you know, you've got agents like McCabe, and you've got agents like is it Strzok?
Yep.
And
Peter Strzok.
Yeah, Peter Strzok and McCabe and Comey. I mean, look, these people are really reprehensible. I mean, they're honestly reprehensible people. You know, I didn't know this until I started doing a little bit of research for this podcast yesterday. McCabe set up a GoFundMe account.
Yeah, is that wrong? Should he not have done that?
Well, it was based on the premise that he was going to lose his entire pension and he needed the money for his legal fees. And he raised $500,000 in 3 days.
Good for him.
$500,000. And this is for anticipated legal fees.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what is he going to do if he doesn't have to pay anticipated legal fees? Is he going to refund those people who gave him $500,000?
So, once you give someone the money, right? I mean, it's
theirs.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can use it on a vacation.
Oh, it's just so gross. I mean, you know, and then Comey going on this book tour and, you know, saying these things that, you're the FBI director. I mean, this guy is a narcissist and is, I'm thinking, universally hated by everyone now.
So the equivalent, like on a local level, would have been like the IMPD chief, right? Like,
bashing the mayor, writing a book about the mayor while the mayor is still in office.
Right. And, would you ever see that? I mean, I can't fathom that happening.
No, and I think that, you know, that is actually something that of sort of recent times. You know, maybe in like the last 10 years or so. Like, I don't think 50 years ago you would ever see somebody leaving a cabinet position post and writing a tell-all book 2 months later.
Because, I mean, like, when you were done being the prosecutor, when you'd done your 2 terms, you were not out there writing a book about Peterson, you know, or Ballard.
No.
And I'm sure you and Peterson had your disagreements. I'll take your silence as consent.
Let's talk about Facebook, because this bothers me, and we're going to have to go into the next segment for this. But so Zuckerberg, first of all, he is irritating. Maybe I'm just having one of those weeks where everybody on TV is irritating. But, but you know, first of all, he's so smug, and you know, his attempts to evade questions, it just seemed very, very condescending. Okay, dude, so you stole Facebook and, you know, you've created a billion dollar company. But this whole idea of algorithms, because when I first thought of social media, I thought that it was like a telephone line, right? That it carried the message, and that message was then posted, and then people got to respond to the message. Like, when did we start talking about like literally creating algorithms so that speech could be censored?
So let me ask you this, and I know we got to go to a break here in just a moment, and I'm sure we'll carry this on into the second segment. Doesn't Zuckerberg have the right to do whatever he wants because it's his company?
Well, so that depends. I mean, you know, this company is a private company, but it's a regulated company, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a publicly traded entity. But the question is, like, if you don't like it, you don't got to use it, right? If you don't like it, you don't got to invest in it. As long as they're telling you whatever they've legally got to tell you as an investor, and that's way above my knowledge, you know, if you're a conservative and you don't like it, no harm, no foul, because you don't got to use it.
Well, does that infringe on net neutrality at all?
Well, I think we're going, net neutrality's going away. See ya. Trump's in office, baby!
Okay, well, I don't know. We can talk about that. But what I'm saying is this, is that, well, if that's all it's going to be, then, I mean, if they're going to be able to start censoring speech, and then I think people need to vote with their feet. That's my opinion. But we can talk about more of that when we come back on Carl Brzee Live. Hey, it's Carl Brzee. Thanks for listening to the podcast. When I was prosecutor, I worked for victims. I worked for holding wrongdoers accountable for their actions. I've now returned to private practice, but I continue to fight for injured victims, and I've collected millions for my clients. I'm Lewis and Wilkins, and I'm easy to find on your smartphone. You type in Carl Brzee Live or on Facebook, CarlBrzeeLive.com. All right, we're back, Carl Brzee Live. We're talking about Facebook and this whole idea of the use of these algorithms to censor speech. Algorithms mean that you are looking for speech, and you are deciding what speech you're going to allow and what speech you're going to censor. And the problem with these algorithms is the subjectivity of the algorithms. Like, who gets to decide what kind of speech is hateful, right? I mean, is racist speech hateful? Well, I think some folks would say that it is. And then, well, what if I hate people who are vegans, you know, or what if I hate people that are, you know, love avocados, or, you know, it creates an environment where you could have a very serious slippery slope. And there's a certain amount of security and self-validation that comes with these social justice warrior identification groups. And those groups are rising because of what's happening on the universities. And it's becoming sort of very popular to identify with these groups because I think, here's an example, Rob. Do you ever watch Black Mirror?
I have not. What's it about?
So it's like this dystopian show, has a series of shows that are not related about the future and how basically messed up the future will be. And one of the episodes, And one of the episodes has to do with this whole idea of like social credits, right? And you're basically your freedom and what you're able to buy and all that is tied to your social credits. And so these people go around and they do things to store up social credits. And that's what I think this whole, like this group think identity stuff that is happening on social media and other places. I think that's what's occurring here is that young people especially, again, they have security and they have validation with the group identity. And what they do is they sort of gang up on other people who disagree with them. And for whatever the reason, because the progressive view of things is apparently the popular way to be, is that their bullying is okay, but any kind of other bullying by other groups is not okay. Does that make sense? I mean, I'm sure you've seen that.
I mean, Does it make sense? No. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but a lot of their thinking doesn't make sense.
Well, right. I mean, and we could sort of just, you know, end with that it doesn't make any sense, except that it's becoming, I mean, it's growing, right? And there's nothing courageous about their groupthink. And then what we're doing is that we're actually creating more of an echo chamber with these social media platforms with algorithms that help speed the collision between the correct speech and the incoherence, right? I mean, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about people who don't have the ability to reason because they're attending universities where they're not taught how to think. They're taught what to think by leftist professors who are resentful because they feel like what they're doing ought to be rewarded more. And then they rail against the power paradigms, the authority, because it makes them feel better about who they are, because they don't want to compete with the rest of us. And I think there's a lot of that, you know, a lot of that with identifying with these certain groups. And I think, oh, I'm a this, or I'm an XX, or I'm a, you know, whatever it is. I think these young people are building up social credits.
It's a fair thing to say. And I just saw, Carl, it's interesting that Starbucks is going to close like 8,000 stores for racial sensitivity training.
Oh, yeah, because of that leaked document.
Right. I mean, not that it's the same thing, but it kind of seems like they just, those ideas are merging together.
Right. And so, look, I mean, at some point, I think fair, decent, and ethical Americans who believe in the freedom of thought and expression will become sufficiently alarmed that we actually start to band together and start to really become conscious of and do something about progressive authoritarianism, because this is how the political spectrum is tilting. And to me, it's a serious malfunction and it's alarming. I don't know. You're younger than I am, so you might not feel as strongly
substantially
about this. Substantially younger than I am. As I'm putting on my glasses so that I can read my notes.
I think you hit the nail on the head, though. But the question becomes, how do you reattain the idea of individualism, mm-hmm. right? I mean, once that cat's out of the bag and society starts moving a certain way, it's like a big clunky dinosaur, right? I mean, it's very hard to move it in a different direction once it gets going.
Yeah, but we have to, because what's on the other side of this is like you know, Mao and Hitler, and I mean, I'm not exaggerating, because when people start to look, we're already talking about disarming Americans. We're already talking about banning words. And when you say banning words, it's not just that you're banning words, right? You're banning thoughts, right? Because just like the creation story. I mean, words mean something, right? And when you start banning that, you're literally trying to ban what people believe. And that, to me, is a serious problem. We're trying to, you know, these people who want to make the world better, right? Because that's how they do this. They crusade on this idea that they want to make the world better. They may think they want to make the world better. What they want is control, and they want power. They want to be able to tell people what to do and how to think. And that's what the Nazis did. That's what the Soviets did. They wanted to make people better. They want to reduce the friction in society, right? And they're quite happy to use violence to do it, as history has shown.
Well, and I saw something, and I don't remember what the percentage was, but there was a huge amount of young people who have no idea what Auschwitz was.
Right.
And it's just like, how could you not know that? But they have no concept of it, what it was, anything. And when you start rewriting history or erasing history, you can't avoid the mistakes of the past if you don't know what happened in the past.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I say this all the time. And it's an intellectually dishonest way of approaching this issue, because what they do is it's not rational and it's not reasonable. It's all purely emotion-based, right? It's all sloganeering and chanting and non sequiturs and everything else. I mean, just like you saw with the Parkland kids. I mean, this, you know, exact same thing. If you, you know, here's one. Okay, so if you support the NRA, you're a murderer. Okay, now that seems to me like a form of hate speech, because I support the NRA. I don't know if you do.
Yes.
I'm a murderer. You're calling me a murderer? I mean, really, what more hateful thing could you say than accusing someone of murder, right? I can't really think of one off the top of my head. And yet that's the kind of speech that's tolerated. That's okay. That's all over Facebook. But those two African-American women, what are their names?
Diamond and Silk. Yeah.
Yeah, they were banned. They were banned from Facebook. But calling people who support the NRA murderers, that's not hate speech. Give me a break. I mean, it is so apparent. And I just hope that people who are listening to WIBC and this podcast, Hammer, Nigel, and others, are taking this as seriously as they need to. Because if you have children, and I've got a couple left.
You've got like 30.
Yeah, I have a lot.
You got like 30 kids.
I have a lot of kids. But, you know, they come back from university, and they have to go through a whole series of deprogramming at my house. It includes waterboarding and other things. I'm kidding. But yeah, you know, you're paying good money for your kids to go to school, and it matters what school they go to and what their leftist professors, which is really a good majority of them, what they're being taught, because this stuff matters, and it matters far beyond, you know, what kind of degree they get. It matters in terms of what kind of world they and their children are going to grow up in. So anyway. So super serious Carl Brizzi Live this week, but I got it off my chest. Now I feel better, and I can enjoy the rest of the radio show. Hey, it's Carl Brizzi. Thanks for listening to the podcast. When I was prosecutor, I worked for victims. I worked for holding wrongdoers accountable for their actions. I've now returned to private practice, but I continue to fight for injured victims, and I've collected millions for my clients. I'm at Lewis & Wilkins, and I'm easy to find on your smartphone. You type in Carl Brizzi Live or on Facebook, carlbrizzilive.com. Hey, thanks for listening to Carl Brizzi Live. You can follow me at Carl Brizzi on Twitter, Carl Brizzi Live on Facebook, and at carlbrizzilive.com. We'll see you next week.